Perhaps you are aware of the Gillette shaving company and its advertisement lately that has the title something along this line, Toxic Masculinity. I guess it raises the question, as that particular thing has it, of what is it that comprises a man, a good man, or in this context, a godly man. It seems to me that we are struggling over precisely that in our society. The advertisement appears to suggest that men are individuals who do not harass or sexually assault women. I'm thinking that's a pretty low bar for men's behavior, but yes, if we need to be clear about that, men don't do that. Don't do that. But I think our society is confused, and has been for some time, as to what precisely a good and godly man might look like. I think about a variety of types of the studies have demonstrated of men in our society at this moment. There would be the real man is a drinking, fist-fighting, womanizing type of person. That's a real man. Or perhaps a second one, a real man would drive a Lamborghini and live in a magnificent mansion and have lots and lots of money to throw around. That's what a real man would be like. There is another version of this, and studies are beginning to show that it's a growing one, a sort of lost generation of men in our society who neither received a trade nor a college degree, who appear to drift from job to job and in the end suffer from a variety of methamphetamine and other drugs, and so they're sort of lost to society in many respects. Broken families, children who are orphaned, and the like. And so that would be another version of man that we've seen out there. Now, I'd like to make the observation that society told us 50 years ago what a man was supposed to be like, and I don't think it was very smart then, society. And society's telling us right now what a man is supposed to look like. I don't think society's any smarter. Now, they're saying different things now, but I think that perhaps the safest place we could go to is the ultimate man. What about Jesus Christ? What kind of a person was he? What kind of a man is he? Now, perhaps before you ladies check out of this sermon and say, oh, well, it's not about me. How would a young woman recognize a good godly man if she was interested in dating or even marrying someone? It seems to me that there's considerations that a young woman might want to look at when she thinks about that. What was Jesus like? Picture in your mind's eye that iconic picture of the long blonde hair, the high cheekbones, and the light or the pale skin. In fact, there is some good evidence that this was an image somebody drew of the iconic Western European man, the sort of back in the 14th or 15th century, what they thought of as a good-looking man in their day. Now, I think we can pretty quickly debunk this and suggest that, for a start, Jesus was a Semite. He was a Jew. He was an Israelite. He would have not been blonde, no doubt. He would have been dark-haired, and he would have probably had darker skin than certainly that iconic picture that we had. But then we can extrapolate from that. What was Jesus like? We don't know if he was tall or short or muscular or anything like that, but he was a man who worked hard. You might recall he was a carpenter before he picked up that preaching gig of his. Right? And so here he was, a man whose hands would have probably had the rough, calloused texture of a man who'd worked with wood and with tools. Where do you suppose he got the wood from when he went out to make a table or a desk or something like that? Is there such a thing as Timber R Us in the first century? Probably not. He had to go out to a mountainside and cut down his own tree. May I observe he probably did not have a chainsaw when he did that. He would have to use shoulders and muscles and an axe to take that tree down. Then he had to bring it down into the workshop and split it into smaller pieces. Or maybe the other way around, he split it into pieces and brought it into the workshop. But my point is to say that he is a man who worked hard all of his life. If you had perhaps touched the biceps, you'd have known the hard, strong muscles of a workman. If you'd shaken his hand, I would have probably walked away wringing it just a little bit, thinking, oh man, you know, another construction worker, just crushed my hand. What did Jesus look like? We don't know, but we have some ideas. Notice what I suppose is the only expression of the appearance of Jesus, the physical appearance of Jesus in Scripture, Isaiah 53. 1 and 2. Who has believed what he has heard from us? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a young plant, and like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. Now, first of all, we would make a mistake if we observe from that that Jesus was ugly, like Igor or something like that. That's not precisely what it says. Notice he says he had no form or majesty that we should look at him. He's simply saying the Hollywood good looks was not what drew people to him. And then he adds, no beauty that we should desire him. Again, it was not that he was good looking or particularly physically significant. I am going to suggest that Jesus must have looked like any one of 100 other Israelites in his day. And you could not have necessarily picked him out in a crowd and seen, you know, 100 Israelite men and said, there he is. Jesus, I can tell from the pictures of that, you know, the glossy cover of his pictures or something like that. You couldn't have done that. You might have been drawn to Jesus by the force of his personality or by the truth of what he was teaching, but you would not have been drawn to him by the way that he appeared physically. But if we look at Jesus, we might begin to ask the question, what does a godly man look like? I don't think that we draw our answers of what a good man looks like from society. Society is rarely right on anything, but I would like to suggest that those of us who are here, these men who are out here, maybe we could say, okay, what was Jesus like? And what can we learn from that? And maybe I'd like to start with something else. It kind of offends me that men have been beaten up so much for the last 20 or 25 years. I don't know what happened. I realize that there are curs like Harvey Weinstein and what was his name? Dr. Huxtable, the actor. I realize that there are people, men, who really let men down in that respect. But I look out across this room and I see good men for the most part. I see godly men. I see men who have set a spiritual tone for their lives and that of their children. And I'm going to suggest that I'm not giving this lesson because I feel like you guys have let the side down or anything, but we can gain from looking at Jesus. First of all, Jesus in the city of Nazareth. This is found in Luke chapter 4, beginning with verse 28. Jesus had gone to Nazareth. He had read scripture in the synagogue, and then he had begun to make some very pointed remarks about the nature of the Jews and the Gentiles. It was not a popular sermon. In fact, it was one that drew the ire of the listeners in that particular day. Jesus is a man of conviction, and he is a man who stands for what he believes in, and he expresses those strong ideas. So the crowd became a lynch-minded crowd. They wanted to kill him. Verse 28 of Luke 4, when they heard these things, all the synagogue was filled with wrath, and they rose up and drove him out of town and brought him to the brow of the hill on which their town was built so that they could throw him down the cliff. Now, I don't know how you'll respond to my sermon this morning, but I'm rather hopeful that you don't throw me off a cliff. That's not what I'm going for this morning. But it looks like that's what they were going to do to Jesus. And then in verse 30, it says, but passing through their midst, he went away. I am fascinated with that image. Here they are, angry, so angry they want to kill a man. And then he turns around. What happened there? They part like a Red Sea. And he walks right through. I wonder if the look in Jesus' eye, if he looked them straight in the eye, as if to say, what I said was true, wasn't it? You're mad because I was right. And they, at some level, acknowledge it. There is a force of personality on this man, Jesus. As we looked at this, the Nazareth crowd understood what he was getting at when he walked through them and when he went on his own way. Then, of course, there's the story of the cleansing of the temple. Find, if you would, John 2, beginning with verse 13. John 2, verse 13 through 17. The Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple he found there those who were selling oxen and sheep and pigeons and the money changers sitting there. And making a whip of cords, he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen. And he poured out the coins and the money changers and overturned their tables. And he told those who sold the pigeons, take these things away. Do not make my father's house a house of trade. His disciples remembered that it was written, zeal for your house will consume me. Now, the first thing I could do as I look at this is ask the question, what was going on? And we have two clues at the end of this passage. This would be in verses 16 and 17, where Jesus says something, and then where John, writing, recording the story, says something as well. So let's start with that. What was it that flipped the switch? What was it that ignited Jesus' action on this particular day? It says in verse 16, "How dare you turn my Father's house into a market?" Jesus appeared to be upset that a place of worship, a time of worship, had become a circus, a marketplace. If you can picture the idea of a market, you guys have been to a market, right? I've been to ones in a third world country, in Zimbabwe. You can picture the fluttering of chickens' wings. You could call the people and the cows tied up to a post and all the other things that are being sold at that particular place. It is not what you would think of as a time and place of worship. The second thing that was suggested is in verse 17, the disciples' memory. Zeal for your house will consume me. What is being suggested is that for Jesus, worship was a very, very important thing. Zeal and consume. Can you picture worship consuming Jesus? Now, let's look at the text that is prior to that then. Jesus walks into the temple. He is, I suppose, prepared to pray and worship and honor God. That is what his purpose was. And he sees this marketplace. What was going on? Let's talk a little bit of history. In the Roman days where Jews came to the temple, Jewish people were scattered all over the Roman Empire. Now, it would be one thing to take a calf, if you live 5 miles out of Jerusalem, and throw a rope around it and bring it into the temple and say to the priest, "Here is my sacrifice." But what if you lived 100 miles away? What if you lived 500 miles away? You wouldn't want to take that calf all the way from your home to Jerusalem. So instead, what they would do is they would come to the city of Jerusalem and there, with money that they had, purchase an animal and bring it to offer as a sacrifice. That makes sense, right? But now, the second challenge that they had was the fact that Roman coins had on them the image of Caesar. You might recall that the Old Testament would say, "You shall have no graven image before me." And here was the image of Caesar on the Roman coins. Now, the Jews had no choice but to use Roman coins in business and in everyday life. But they believed that they did not need to use it at the temple at a time of worship. What you would do, and I suppose it would be made worse by the fact that many of the Caesars considered themselves divine. So that would certainly go against the Ten Commandments. So this is what would happen. You come to the temple with money. You'd exchange the Roman money with the image of Caesar for approved Jewish money. And with that new money, you would go approach the person selling the sheep or the cattle or the pigeons and so on. And then you would offer that as a sacrifice. But you can also imagine the scenario with the fluttering of wings, the mooing and the lowing and the calling of the man and all that kind of thing in that particular scene. And apparently it got Jesus angry. Now, my point is, for a second time, Jesus was a man of deep conviction. And there were times when he took action on it. Now, picture what he was suggesting. It says that he picked up a bunch of cords and made a whip out of it. Can you picture it like this? He had about that much play. He wrapped some of the cords around his wrist and he began to swing. Can you imagine him swinging the cords on rump of cow, rump of sheep, rump of salesman? Can you imagine him grabbing tables? Can you imagine the sound of the change dropping to the ground as he threw tables down and the piles of money hit the ground? Can you hear the lowing and the mooing and the objections and the whole crowd moving towards the exit of the building? Can you picture all that? And can you also picture the fact that they came out in the streets of the city of Jerusalem and you wondered what it was inside that was driving all these people out, and you realize it was not the whole Roman army massacring Jews, it was one man, Jesus himself. Now, you might ask yourself an important question. Was Jesus angry that day? Now, with that in mind, read, if you would, with me, Mark 3, beginning with verse 1. Mark 3, 1 through 6. "Again he entered the synagogue, and a man was there with a withered hand. And they watched Jesus to see whether he would heal him on the Sabbath, so that they might accuse him. And he said to the man with the withered hand, 'Come here.' And he said to them, 'Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save life or to kill?' But they were silent. And he looked around with them." Please note, my friends, he looked around with them with anger, grieved at their hardness of heart, and said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He stretched it out, and his hand was restored. The Pharisees went out and immediately held counsel with the Herodians against him to destroy him. Now, notice the story here, and notice the fact that the Bible says in specific words, Jesus was angered. Now, I pause. I'm saying this advisedly. No, I don't think that real godly men go up and down the countryside losing their temper and kicking cats and dogs and pushing people around. I don't think that's what we're trying to suggest. Here is a man of conviction, and here is a man who saw something that was unfair and unjust, and that made him angry. And I guess I'd like to raise the question, what is it that should make us angry? And what kinds of things should we just leave alone and say, well, no, I'm not going to become angry about that. Somebody says, well, isn't it a sin always to be angry? Can I direct your attention to Ephesians 4, verses 26 and 27? Ephesians 4, 26 and 27. Be angry, Paul writes, and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger, and give no opportunity to the devil. Now, this particular passage is telling us that it is possible to be angry and not sin. I recognize that sometimes when we're angry, we are very close to sinning. We have lost control of ourselves. We are no longer thinking clearly. And so the next thing we say or the next thing we do might be an angry, sinful thing. But notice he says you can be angry and not sin. But then he gives us some very good advice in this section. He says, be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger. I think what he means is don't let the anger rumble and boil for days and weeks and weeks. Now, I think we've all seen people, and maybe we've felt it ourselves, this rolling, boiling resentment against other people that goes on for weeks or months or even longer than that. And Paul's saying, don't do that. Then he adds, and give no opportunity to the devil. I'm suspecting that the devil is gleefully taking advantage of that anger that we have, the one that we're holding for a long, long time. But I would like to make that observation. It appears to be possible for a real man, like a Paul or like a Jesus, to see injustice and be angry about that. Now, it might say something about you if you're not angry about some things. Have you guys ever heard stories of some telemarketer phoning a grandmama, and the grandmama just gave up her life savings to this dimwit who is taking advantage of people? Doesn't that make you angry? It makes me angry. It makes me angry that that a grandmother with all of her savings, her meager savings, gave it up to this person who did that. What about a person who abuses a child, beats up or sexually or otherwise hurts a child? That makes me angry. I guess I'd like to suggest that if it did not make me angry, there would be something wrong with me. You see. However, a Christian man responds in a way that would reflect more of what Jesus or the Apostle Paul is suggesting. Now, can I do a counterbalance? Because I don't want to give an impression of a man walking around like that thug with the fingers trailing along the ground, you know, saying things in monosyllables, ugh, or something like that. That's not what we're suggesting at all. Find Matthew 19, verses 13 through 15. Matthew 19, verses 13 through 15. Then children were brought to him that he might lay his hands on them and pray. The disciples rebuked the people, but Jesus said, let the little children come to me and do not hinder them, for to such belongs the kingdom of heaven. And he laid his hands on them and went away. I want to note a couple of things in these verses that are pretty important. First of all, here was Jesus prepared to shut off other activity, preaching, teaching, developing apostles, to be with children. And I think that's pretty significant. Let the children come to me and do not hinder them. I think one of the most magnificent images I can think of is of a man in his home, on his knees, perhaps with an easy chair and his elbows there, and two children tucked up underneath him as he prays. And they pray with him. Sometimes they go to sleep in that position. That's all right. I just love the image of a man praying, a father praying with his children. And I love this idea of the Lord drawing children to him. Notice that twice in these verses, it says that he touched them. So these children were brought to him that he might lay his hands on them. That's verse 13. And then in verse 15, and he laid his hands on them and went away. I am very much aware of the concerns that society has regarding appropriate and inappropriate touching. And I am not at all suggesting that the inappropriate part should ever be done by a Christian man, but I am also suggesting that we know that the tactile perception is important for children's development. Have you read stories of those orphans in places like Russia and the former Yugoslavian countries that had orphanages that were, the babies just lay there and nobody picked them up and loved them? And I'm picturing in a good society, a society that's whole and healthy, where dad walks in and picks up a baby. Or where grandpa walks in and takes the hands of his grandson and granddaughter and takes them places. And I'm suggesting that in fact, the studies have suggested that those children that did not have those advantages are, for the rest of their lives, behind in development of the children that receive proper and appropriate touch and proper and appropriate care. It seems to me that both little boys and little girls need a dad, need a man, need a father. Both boys and girls need to see their father take Christianity seriously. If I can use the old bumper stickers that were once out there. Real men love Jesus. It's true. Real men do. That is the essence of manliness. You talk about toxic masculinity. This is healing masculinity. Now, you may say to yourself, I'm a little concerned about the religion part. Does that emasculate me? When I sing hymns, does that mean that I'm less of a man than anybody else? And I'd like to suggest that the heroes of the Bible, the men who are heroes of the Bible, an Abraham and a Moses and a David and a Daniel and a Paul and a Peter and a James and yes, indeed, a Jesus were real men. They sang hymns. They put God first. They lived the lives that they should. Why is this important? Well, I did start out by making the observation that not only men need to know this, but women as well. What does a good, godly man look like? A godly man is strong. He's convicted, but about godly things. He's a man who stands up for what's right. He's also a gentleman. I picture Jesus touching these children. I picture the fact that the strongest man who ever lived was also gentle. Gentle enough to hold them. I was thinking of a story that I'd read a number of years ago. You may recognize a character, a large church in Chicago, and they had one of those nursing places, nursery areas where children could go. And so moms and dads were putting children in there, and somebody was a little alarmed because there was a big man in there looking after the kids. 6'4" and muscular and obviously a powerful man. And they wondered, who is he and is this all right? And somebody said, you don't know who that is? That's Mike Singletary, linebacker for the Chicago Bears back then. And I guess my point is, here is a good man, a powerful man, but a man that you could trust with the little children. So this morning, what is a good Christian man like? A good Christian man loves the Lord. He loves his children and his wife. A good Christian man puts Jesus first. A good Christian man does not, of course, ever assault other people, particularly women. But a good man, a good Christian man, is a man who comes here. I'm not suggesting, men, that you must be articulate or that you must preach sermons and that you must do Bible classes, though it would be wonderful if you did. I'm suggesting that your children and your neighborhood and your family and your spouses know what's most important in your life. Are you showing that? That's what I'd like to know. This morning, perhaps you would like to have an opportunity to renew that, to indeed put Jesus first. Or maybe you need to become a Christian. In that case, you could be buried with Jesus in baptism and live the only convicted life that is actually worth living, the one for the Lord Jesus, the ultimate man. Would you come as we stand and as we sing?